Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Now, I should have an Alan on the line with me.
Hello.
Hello, Alan. How are you?
Calling Lillian. Here we go.
It's good to hear from you. How's things going?
Well, I've got to say it's a stunning day out here in Titirangi. The sky is blue, blue, blue.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
I've got a cat on my lap and, you know, all is right with the world, really.
You've got a cat. I don't think we know that about you yet.
I've got four cats.
Four cats. Okay. That escalated.
Yes, I know. One of them decided to bring a mouse in at about 3 o'clock this morning. Oh. So, of course, I had to go and rescue that. Nice. Okay. Anyway.
Well, I guess let's move from mice to other types of not mice. Anyway, let's talk about quantum computers.
Let's talk about quantum computers. It's a bit of a stretch going from mice to quantum computers.
Well, yeah. I mean, computers sometimes have mice, don't they?
Oh, very good. Very good. Didn't think of that. Yes, well done. Well done. Okay, so we'll kick off today and we're going to talk about quantum computers. And so the question then becomes, why are these different from normal computers? And how are they going to change the world? And what's been done on them recently? So the answer to those questions...
All of the above.
Eventually. How do computers work? Well, basically computers work on what is called a binary system. It's a whole bunch of zeros and ones, okay? And these are bits, we call them bits, and basically a bit can have a value of a zero or a one, and or you could think of it as being a switch maybe, a switch is on or off. It's only got two possible values, okay? And using this type of computing, we can make, you know, extraordinarily powerful computers that are all based on these bits, these ones and zeros. And, you know, that's how a computer works. Don't ask me exactly how a computer works because I really don't know. But it's all based on these bit things, okay?
Bits. Great. Got it.
Bits. Right. So quantum computers are going to be the next generation of computers. And they are going to operate using things called qubits. Now, the quantum comes in on computers, because we're getting down into the weird world of quantum mechanics where things just do not operate like they do in our supposedly real world. So when you get down to the very, very, very small, things start getting very, very, very weird. And what we find in quantum mechanics is that instead of these bits being able to be either on or off or one or zero or whatever, they can be both of those things at once, okay? So qubits can be on and off at the same time, or they can be one and zero at the same time. And this is weird, and this is beyond anybody's comprehension, really, but this is the way that the universe works on the tiny, tiny, tiny scale, okay? And you think, okay, so whoop-de-doo, what's so great about the superposition thing? Well, as I can hear you asking, Lillian, so what's so great about that? It means that instead of a computer doing a calculation, let's say it's trying to solve a maze, let's say. Okay, you set a computer a task of solving a maze. It's going to go down every dead end and back again and keep repeating until it finds its way out of the maze, okay? So a quantum computer basically can do all of the paths in a maze at the same time.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
That's handy.
So you can see that that's going to make an enormous difference in terms of time, computing power, okay? So instead of doing everything consecutively, it can do it simultaneously, okay? And in the quantum world, we've also got this thing called entanglement, which is really, really, really weird. And basically that says that two particles, if they're entangled, they can communicate with each other at speeds faster than light. Somehow one knows what the other's doing. Even if they're moving apart at the speed of light, they still know what the other one's doing, which is really, really weird. All to do with quantum mechanics, which is why we want quantum computers. Right, so now I've built it up.
Yeah.
How do we make a quantum computer? Well, we're still in the very infancy of doing that. One of the leaders in all of this is Google, and they have made a quantum computer that consists of about 50 or 60, something like that, qubits, these weird quantum mechanical things. And what they find is that, yes, they can get this thing working, but they've got to operate it at a temperature of about 0.01 degrees above absolute zero, the coldest temperature there is. Okay, so 0.01 degrees above absolute zero. So that's going to kind of limit its use, obviously. You've got to run it at that sort of temperature. And the more qubits that you have, the more heat gets generated, and you've got to keep them cold, otherwise they don't work. And so therefore, we've got all sorts of problems there. So there's a bunch of workers in Australia at University of New South Wales and in the Netherlands who have just this week published papers separately, in fact, in Nature, and they've managed to fabricate some devices that are based on silicon that can work at, wait for it, 1 degree above absolute zero.
Wow.
Now, you might think that there's not a heck of a lot of difference between 0.01 degrees above absolute zero and 1 degree above absolute zero. But well, in fact, that's two orders of magnitude. That's 2 powers of 10.
Yeah. You know? Of course, I was thinking there's not much difference, but I do feel like Alan has something up his sleeve. So,
well, in fact, that's 100 times different, okay? And so what this means is that now that they can get them to work at 1 Kelvin or 1 degree above absolute zero, that makes the cooling issue a hell of a lot easier, okay? It's much easier to keep something cold at around about 1 Kelvin than it is to keep something cold at around about 0.01 Kelvin, okay? And so they're saying that, yes, you know, this is a big advance, and it is, and they will now be able to use these in hopefully ever more powerful quantum computers that contain more of these qubits and that are going to eventually change the world for us, okay? So this is the next enormous thing, absolutely huge.
Okay.
And one of the things about this, okay, so you know how we've all got, you know, encryption and all of that. We've all got our passwords and stuff, and they're all encrypted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Hopefully well encrypted. When we get quantum computers, that's going to mean that we're going to need a new form of encryption, basically, because a lot of the encryption that goes on is based on multiplying two very, 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 very large numbers together, okay, to come up with an enormous number that has only got two factors, and those two factors are prime numbers. And working out what those factors of this enormous number is basically impossible, even with the supercomputers that we've got today, okay? Quantum computers, they'll be able to do that, you know, bam, just like that.
Yeah.
The world will change when quantum computers come online, and we'll have to have a new form of encryption. And of course, people are working on this even as we speak. So that will change the world. So,
how far away are we talking, or how much time will this take to get those?
Or how long is a piece of string? It's you know, it's going to rely on these sorts of advances that are being made even now. So, you know, they've got to 1 Kelvin now. They might get to 2 Kelvin next year. They might get to 10 Kelvin. Who knows, you know?
Wow.
But it's fabulous stuff, and all based on these quantum effects that are just so against what we would call common sense, and that's the way the universe works. It all works on probability. That's the way. There's no certainty in the universe. It's all about probability.
Oh, yes. Good call. All right. Shall we move into the long-lost natural blue colour?
We shall, yeah, because this is really nice. And again, this is a paper published this week by a bunch of workers in Portugal. And so the guts of it is that if ever you've looked at old manuscripts and stuff like that, if ever you've, you know, had the chance to go to sort of museums, probably more overseas than here, and see these beautiful illuminated manuscripts which are full of all of these, you know, handwritten and hand-painted letters and little pictures and stuff like that, you know, absolutely beautiful things. And the blue that was used as a dye in these illuminated manuscripts was known to people in around about the 12th and the 14th and the 15th century. So we've got sort of surviving manuscripts on how to make this blue material that come all the way from back in the 12th century, which is quite amazing. Now, the blue that they used kind of fell out of favor after sort of 15th, 16th, 17th century and sort of got lost. And now these folk in Portugal have now gone and reinvestigated what this blue material actually is, because funnily enough, there's not a lot of natural blue dyes out there. Okay, right. So there's indigo, which is used for essentially dyeing your blue jeans. That's a natural blue dye. And there is things called anthocyanins, which come from certain flowers and stuff like that. So there's some blues in there as well. But it's not a particularly common natural dye color. And so these folk in Portugal were very interested in what the chemical makeup of this particular dye was. So they went back to these old texts from the 12th and the 14th and the 15th century. And they followed the recipes in the texts, which I think is absolutely brilliant, on how to make this blue dye. And in order to do this, they had to go to southern Portugal, which explains why the workers were in Portugal. And they had to get a little herb called Crozophora tinctoria. And that
Say
is
that one
source.
More time.
I wish I could help. Crozophora tinctoria.
Wow. How's that?
And so they followed the recipe, and they got the blue extract out of this herb. And then, using all of the modern equipment that they have got at their fingertips, they managed to determine what the chemical structure of this stuff was. And it turned out to be totally unlike any other sort of dye that is known, any other sort of natural dye. So they've basically found an entirely new type of dye molecule, natural dye molecule.
Wow.
And I reckon that's really, really nice. So it took them 2 years to do this. So there's some fairly intensive work going on there. And you might think, okay, so what, you know, what would be the possible application of this? Or is it just to, you know, satisfy the curiosity? And the answer is a bit of both, but you can certainly imagine that there's obviously big business in forgeries these days. There's all sorts of very interesting documentaries and stuff like that sort of floating around Netflix on art forgery and stuff like that. And again, these illuminated manuscripts are not above being forged. However, now people know what the structure of the blue compound is in these authentic illuminated manuscripts. Now that's going to be a big weapon against forgery of these things, for which people would pay, you know, big money for these things. So I think that's a good thing.
Sounds amazing. And I like blue. I'm glad we figured that out.
Well, there we go. I've got cats and you like blue. There we go. We didn't know it about each other.
Let's finish with this last story because we have to run through it quickly, but it's quite important, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes. Okay, so plastics. Okay, they're either the saviour of humanity or they're a blot on humanity, depending on who you believe. Probably the answer lies somewhere in between with those. I remember going to Cyprus a few years ago, and washed up on the beach, there was just plastic everywhere. I just couldn't believe it, in the middle of the Mediterranean. And you know, we really don't see it perhaps so badly here in New Zealand, but certainly other parts of the world, you know, the plastic plague, I guess, in the oceans and the seas and stuff like that is just dreadful. So what do we need? We're not going to stop using plastic, because that would require us to invent some whole new material, okay? Because, you know, we live in the age of plastic now. Everything is plastic. We can't do without it at the moment anyway. So the next best thing to basically banning plastic is to make plastic degradable. So you make degradable plastic so that, you know, if you do discard them, then they're going to degrade, and hopefully they're going to degrade down
completely.
To... Yeah, right. Completely. Not leave materials that are themselves going to be pollutants. So there's some workers at Cornell University in the States who have, again this week, just published a paper on a polymer called isotactic polypropylene oxide.
One more time.
Rolls off the tongue. See, if you're a chemist, you get to, you know, these names just become sort of second nature. You can just roll off.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Now, and this is a polymer, or a plastic, you know, same thing, that has been known since around about 1949, in fact. However, these guys went back and studied it and were looking at the possibility of using this as some sort of plastic. Now, one of the problems that you're going to have to overcome if you're going to make a degradable plastic is it's got to be strong, obviously. It's got to have the strength that plastic has But then you've got to build into it the ability for it to degrade. And this polypropylene oxide actually works both ways in terms of this. It is strong, but it also degrades if you expose it to ultraviolet light.
Wow. Okay?
So in other words, if you leave it out in the sunlight, then it's going to degrade on you.
That's brilliant.
Well, it is and it isn't, isn't it? I mean, you can see things going both ways here. Who's going to want to buy some sort of plastic that, you know, in 30 days, if you leave it out in the sun, it's going to be useless? But, you know, one of the biggest users of plastic is sort of the fishing industry, apparently, and that's where a lot of the plastic waste comes from. And so you could sort of foresee, you know, people hopefully being able to use something like this and then, you know, maybe not just discarding it, but, you know, putting it aside somewhere. And then within a month, these workers found the polymer chains. Now, these polymers, they're big, 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 long molecules that contain literally thousands of atoms, okay? Mm-hmm. And big chains. Now, if you can take those big chains and chop them into smaller chains, then the bugs can start working on those smaller chains, and then they can biodegrade those smaller chains.
Wow.
And eat them all up, and basically you end up with totally benign products from that. So,
wow.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of work is going into this stuff, especially sort of biodegradable polymers, but this is one where they're looking at, you know, the action of ultraviolet light and photo degradation of these things followed by biodegradation. So,
right.
You know, this again, as a lot of the stories that I talk about are, this is just a start, okay? So,
yeah.
You know, these are preliminary results, but, you know, it's
but very positive.
Yeah, it's pointing the right way. We have to do something about the plastic problem. And, you know, the microbiologists are finding bugs that can actually eat plastic. You know, there's another way of
doing it. Is that bad for the bugs?
And they actually, well, no, they've actually evolved to eat plastic.
Whoa.
That's if you believe in evolution, of course.
Alan.
I won't go there.
Let's not start at the end of the segment. Okay.
If you give a bug nothing else to eat but plastic, it evolves so that it can eat plastic, which is quite amazing. But
also unfortunate that they were forced to eat plastic in the first place.
Indeed. I agree. Yes. I agree.
All right. Thank you so much, Alan, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Yeah.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
It's time.